Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Kavanagh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable. Gone with the Wind, when we're not in someone's head, is kind of written in that nice omniscient third. And some of those are very poetic passages. They're quite well written. And I think those are the passages that make readers see Gone with the Wind as a book that glorifies the Old South, Lost Cause mythology. And I know that as we move into a future episode's teaser, we will suss that out. Mm-hmm. And honestly, in reading Gone with the Wind, it took me a while to try to figure out, okay, is that Mitchell talking? Mm-hmm. Is that kind of a just setting the tone for what's going on in the majority of the characters' heads? Mm-hmm. But I do think now that, you know, I've finished the book, I've thought on it more, I have come to appreciate that very alternately Mitchell will write something that glorifies the Old South, but then criticizes it. And mm-hmm. so it is, I think, a lot deeper study of the birth of this Lost Cause mythology in the Old South than a lot of people do give it credit for. She is looking at it critically, even though at times she may look at it nostalgically. It's not a clear cut yes or no, this is wrong, this is good. It's a lot of different thoughts put together that you would get in any kind of a complex society, and I appreciate that more.
Yeah, I think that's really true, and I think, you know, I think that the book gets a bad rap, and the movie doesn't do it any favors, but we'll go into that when we talk about adaptations of all of our choices this year. But I think it gets a bad rap because I have a feeling that people I've talked to in my lifetime, they seem to think Gone with the Wind was like the first book ever written about Civil War and Reconstruction. Like, I'm like, no, you know, this didn't start the Lost Cause mythology. It didn't, you know, it's not that book, you know. So, but I also think that, you know, I mean, only a crazy nerd reader like myself would, you know, fall in love with a book at age, you know, 5 or 6, and then spend, you know, the rest of her life, I'm about to be 57, you know, at different times of my life, going and researching Margaret Mitchell and reading everything I could read about her and her life and all the research she did about this book and everything. Not everybody's going to do that, you know, but it helps if you dive into all that kind of research. And, you know, a lot of it's available on the internet now. Now, I was doing research back when you had to go to libraries and stuff, so, you know, but you can begin to understand that this novel reflects so much of her own life and perspectives regarding how she saw the South as a child versus how she saw the South as an adult. Now she's on record in interviews sometimes contradicting herself, because at one point in an interview, I know she said something like, it's not a historical novel. And I'm like, does she not know the definition of historical novel? Because, you know, this isn't a historical novel. It actually is. And then another time she was on record as saying something like, all these characters were just completely made up in her head. They weren't modeled on anybody she ever knew or anything. And it's just like, that's just, you know, if you know anything at all about her, even just her family ancestry, Margaret Mitchell's family ancestry is very similar to Scarlett O'Hara's. I mean, it's kind of like, okay, was she in self-denial, or did she just not want to say publicly, you know, that I modeled, you know, some of my characters after people I knew? Because the people she knew might get mad. You know, they might not want to be, you know, what's that funny saying? Is it, be careful how you treat me, you'll end up a character in my novel, you know? I mean, she might have just been protecting, you know, the people that she actually knew. But to me, it seems very clear that the book is that evolution of her perspective as a human being, a woman, a white woman in the South from childhood through adulthood as told in an historical novel format. I think that's kind of my takeaway of the structure of the book. I think it excuse me, it's very everything she put into it was so well researched, and there are a lot of stuff you can look up about how much research she actually did. It took her 10 years to write the book. I mean, that's a lot of work, you know. So, but you know, I feel like we're gonna just get more and more and more meat off the bone of Gone with the Wind as our discussions go on. But let's move on to Dracula.
Dracula. I loved the structure of Dracula.
I know.
It is written as this amalgamation of everything from first-person letters to journal entries. Sometimes the journal entries are written. Sometimes they are dictated into machines.
Yeah.
We get to hear from a variety of characters. We never hear from Dracula. We never hear from Van Helsing.
Right.
Except
Except in dialogue, we hear...
Right, correct. Yeah, we never get to hear from, like, their journal entries is what I mean.
Right.
Or their letters or their telegrams.
Right.
So, and it's kind of you call it exact contemporary, so it's like a minute-by-minute,
yeah,
you know, progression of this mystery and this action sequence. So, tell me about Wilkie Collins.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the dedication in the beginning of the book, Stoker himself uses the phrase exact contemporary. So that's really his phrase, not mine. And since he wrote the book, I take him at his word, you know. It's a technique that he borrowed. I mean, he's on record of noting that he borrowed it from Wilkie Collins's The Woman in White, which was published in 1860, where thoughts and dialogue inform all the characters' thoughts and feelings. So that's just a structural technique that I find. I think Bram Stoker does it really well. Like you, it's a fascinating. It kind of jumps around a bit because you read something from Jonathan Harker's journal, and then like two chapters later, the same time is happening in Mina Harker's journal or Lucy's letter or something. And you're like, wait a minute, I got to go back and you know, other stuff has happened since then. So that's a little hard for me, but. Tell me what you think about this. Tell me a little more about what you think about the impact of the structure on this novel.
Sure. So there is a preference, and especially the type of writing that I do and the type of conferences I go to where it's more of genre fiction, not literary fiction.
Right.
It's a modern preference for limited third person.
Okay.
And I enjoy that style. I like to stay with one character in that straightforward narrative. It's the chronological narrative. And so the fact that this one bounces from, okay, we're with Jonathan, we're in the castle, and now, wait, we're on a boat, what's happening? You know, at first I thought this is going to be really jarring, but I liked it for the mystery value.
Mm-hmm.
That in each segment, we, the reader, now have collectively all the clues, whereas each character, we know that, oh, if you only knew what that character does,
right.
Oh, it really adds to the suspense.
Well, it's almost like watching a play. We're watching it play out, and the characters in the play don't know the next, you know, they don't necessarily know what happened in the scene before if they weren't in that scene, you know, so.
Right. Well, and also just when we know that, you know, such and such a character is proceeding blithely, and we're like, whoa, because I have this clue, it's really building my own anticipation, because I know, So I liked that feeling of extra suspense that you got because of the format.
Yeah, I like that too. You said in your notes there's that feeling of threat. And I think that's so important in this particular book, because threat is what makes this story beyond beyond its contextual setting. Okay, time that it's taking place. The story takes place in a certain time. It was written by Bram Stoker at a certain, you know, in a certain time period. Beyond that, the threat level in this book gives it that horror, gothic horror. Status and story that it is now like one of the most it's the example of that kind of writing, if you will, and I think that's such a that's such a great thing that you mentioned in your notes about that feeling of threat.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I don't know. I've read so many books. I say a kajillions of books in my notes. It's really kind of pathetic how many books I've read. But I don't know that I ever really had a preference for one voice of narrator or another. I do prefer like a linear story. So, you know, that's one thing. But I just realized as I was writing my notes for this podcast that I've written prose and poetry all in person voices, in all types of person voices, like first person, third person, you know, whatever. I've done that too. I do like fairly linear storytelling. There's a lot of modern day movies and books now where, you know, the audience has to kind of like jump around in time to follow the story or jumping around in time in characters' lives. And sometimes there's not a lot of explanation that the time has changed. You know, like the hairstyle might be different and then you're like, oh, this is clearly not the same time period because they have a different hairstyle, you know. And if that's not really well done, to me it can just be very confusing, thinking, wait, did the stuff in this scene happen before or after the stuff 3 scenes ago or 6 scenes ago? And so I'm not so comfortable with that. Now, in 3 of our 4 books this year, our narrators tell fairly straightforward linear stories. Events unfold chapter by chapter in fairly chronological order. Dracula is the one that doesn't do that. It's so interesting because the full story unfolds linearly, but across several third-person points of view. So like you said, we do time hop. We do jump between these various characters in particular moments in time as they tell us what happened as their chapters unfold. It's crazy, right? So for out of all our books this year, Dracula is a bit timey-wimey, and I do like that in this particular story. I think the use of newer technology also plays a role here in this book, and we don't really have that in our other books. Dr. John Seward is one of the characters in the book, and his section are his diaries, but they're recorded on phonograph. And Mina is valuable to the team that's going to go after Dracula because she can transcribe in shorthand. So this is new technology and science sitting in opposition of old superstitions. And we feel that tension between the enlightenment of the new that can't fully wash away the truth of the superstitious past. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a wonderful element in this book, Dracula. I really do.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah, I really enjoyed the fact that it was a phonograph as well for exactly the reason you say. I thought that was great.
Yeah. Next, we'll talk about structure in Little Women and Jane Eyre. This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.